Good evening, everyone. Yeah, the retreat was so nice. It was just so nice to see a packed hall. And it was interesting because when I came in, I was mentioning normally we have to do an icebreaker, but I never felt like there was any ice to break. It was just like meeting old friends. So it was really, really nice experience and got to connect with quite a few of you and hope to connect more in the coming months and the coming year. So yeah, really excited for today as well. We're going to do something a little different. We're just going to kind of go a little freestyle today and just have some questions and answers, see what's on your mind, and a little more interaction with everyone. So yeah, please, if you're out there and you can, put your video on. It would be great to see you because it's a great opportunity for all of us to connect and just, yeah, it really makes a difference when we see each other. Even virtually. So yeah, oh, lots more cameras going on. I see you. Siva Sultan, look at that big smile. That's wonderful. He deserves an award for that smile. It's beautiful. Usha, nice to see you. Emily, nice to see you. Kusum. It's nice to see the names and the faces because we often see all of you making comments or dropping messages. So it's nice to put a face to the name. Robin, nice to meet you. Where are you, Robin? That looks like you're in a. Are you a doctor? Is that a massage table or a psychotherapist or?
kind of, yes. I was trying to blur the screen, but couldn't do it in time.
We busted you. Nice to see you. Thanks for joining this evening. Great. Wonderful. Wow. Look at all these eager faces. Okay. I'm feeling the pressure now. Wow. Great. So, yeah, we're going to do a little questions and answers today. We had a bunch of anonymous questions that we didn't get through. So, we've got those questions in backup. Here we go. Pritesh is firing the questions already. I was just about to say, start putting your questions up if you like to. So, yeah, Pritesh has put a question up there. And everyone, do please. Yeah, we're just going to keep the chat open today. So just put whatever questions you have down. Raj, shall we begin with a prayer and then take it from there?
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah. Om Gyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Om Agyanatimirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Thank you so much. Just to say that we are over the coming months, we're going to share more prayers with you, more Sanskrit prayers. We're just kind of opening with that prayer. And as time goes by, we'll share more with you. But yeah, really nice to see everyone. So yeah, please do, if you have questions at any point, things that have been on your mind, then you can put it in the chat. And I think they can also put their, just put your hands up as well, rather than even putting it on the chat. Just raise your hand and then we'll have a little queue going and then it'll be great to hear from all of you. So yeah, Raj, over to you. Let's kick off. We've got like an hour, so let's see where we go.
Yeah, okay. So we've got some really good questions. I've got a sheet of questions actually. We had anonymous questions come in, and I kept the sheet because some of them didn't get answered in our Q&A session. So yeah, let's answer it from let's start one from here. And then yeah, please keep sending them on the chat. You can send them to us directly or on the main chat, and then we'll just pick it up. Okay, so the first question I'm gonna fire at you. It's an anonymous question. Okay, and it's about people having the spirit of competition. So this person has said, why is it that automatically we have a sense of competition? He's described an example. He was on a hike. Wait, I say he, it could be a she. Sorry. They were on a hike and in Norway, and they were like, they ran across some stepping stones, and there was a guy in front of him, and he just really wanted to beat that person and get ahead. And in that process, that he fell. So he kind of is describing like, how do we stop this natural competitive nature that we all have?
Amazing. What a great question. Yeah. They say there are three cancers of the mind: competition, comparison, and criticism. These are the three cancers of the mind that many of us suffer from. Well, let's begin with the kind of bigger picture. A few weeks ago, we were talking about yoga and how the purpose of life is to connect with the divine, to find that spiritual relationship of love that we're all looking for, to reawaken divine love. And the basic fact of life is that most of us don't have that connection. Most of us don't have that relationship. Most of us don't have that union with the divine. And because we haven't managed to connect with the supreme, the complete whole, what the end result of that is that if we don't have that relationship with the supreme whole, then we end up feeling incomplete. And not only incomplete, we end up feeling insecure. And therefore, everyone in this world, to a greater or lesser extent, struggles with insecurity, isn't it? Put your hands up if you feel, sometimes you feel a little insecure in your life, isn't it? All of us do. We feel insecurity, and therefore we're always looking for acceptance. We're always looking for appreciation. We're always looking for acknowledgement. And we're always trying to build a sense within ourselves that we are worthy, that we're that we have value. And why is that we have so much insecurity? Because we have not established our relationship with the supreme whole, and therefore we're feeling inadequate. And then the natural result of feeling insecure is that we end up competing with everyone. We try to prove to others, prove to ourselves that no, we're okay, we're doing better than others, because we feel a sense of vacuum within. And therefore, you see that in the material world, everyone is competing because everyone feels insecure. But it's said in spiritual community, where people are genuinely connecting with the Supreme, that competition is replaced with people empowering, encouraging, and elevating and serving each other. And that's basically the difference between the material world and the spiritual world. So the more and more we become connected to the Supreme, and we feel the love, the nourishment of love that comes from that relationship, then the more and more we are whole and secure and fulfilled within, and therefore we don't feel the need to compete with others. We don't need to get ahead of others. We don't need to prove that we're worthy, because we know we have a connection with the Supreme Divinity, and that gives us full value in our life. So yeah, competition comes because of spiritual vacuum, and all of us have that. So yeah, we're always competing. It's crazy. But they say even if you win the rat race, you're still a rat. So we don't want to just win the competition of the material world, but we want to transcend the competition of the world by feeling spiritual fulfillment. Yeah. I don't know, Raj, you have any thoughts on that? Or if anyone wants to add anything to that on the call, by all means, put your hand up. And
yeah, it's interesting, because we live in a world where we're taught from a young age, you know, you got to be the best, you got to try your best, not just about trying your best, but about being the best. And we have this like constant, constant thing that sometimes we're not enough, and we have to do things to prove certain things. And And actually, you're right. Like when we have that spiritual fulfillment, then we actually realize that God loves us for who we are. And it's not about being the best. It's about trying your best. Because when you try your best, it's you're doing the best of your ability to be where you are. And you are where you should be. But if you start, you know, comparing yourself and start having this competitive mentality, because, you know, they say like your best competition is yourself when you look back at who you are, rather than looking at comparing with others and et cetera. And and that constant vacuum can be filled with spiritual connection, because the idea is that God loves you and you love God, you know. So
I think Ankit made a great point on the, just to reiterate your point, he said compete only with yourself from yesterday. So instead of comparing and competing with others, why not compare and compete with yourself to see what growth you've created, and that you're improving yourself? That's a great answer. Yeah. One monk once said to me, and I always found it profound, he said, it requires spiritual advancement to feel compassion in someone else's distress. But he said it requires even more spiritual advancement to genuinely feel happy in someone else's success. So it's just like we have this such envy within us, this envy competitive mentality, because we are not fulfilled in ourselves. But when you're full, then you have no envy towards anyone. Rather, you're just wishing everyone grows to the greatest extent they can. So, yeah.
I'm going to ask a bit of a spin-off question on this. You know, in the Bhagavad Gita, we have, you know, the war is about to happen. And there's a character in there called Duryodhana, who, you know, we read at the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. So what's your take on him? Because he was quite successful, but he was very, his motives were not there, and he was quite an envious person. So what could we learn from that
character? Yeah, it's interesting, because Duryodhan and his brothers, they met with a lot of success in their life, actually. And you sometimes you think, like, the good guys never win, you know, like they never turn out. You sometimes think you have to be a bit heavy-handed to get ahead in this world. But one thing we learn from the Kauravas is that although they got all this success, two things happened. That success, number one, was not sustainable. It eventually all broke down. And the second lesson you learn from their success is that that success didn't actually bring them inner fulfillment and happiness. So there's a sense in which when we pursue success in the wrong way, then neither will that success be sustainable, and neither will that success actually make you really feel happy. You may have had that experience that you kind of, sometimes you get something that you really wanted, but you did it in the wrong way. And then later on, once you get it, it's just like, I got it, but I just feel like it just doesn't sit well within you, because you think like, I didn't do it in the right way. I think that the Kauravas are good examples of that, of how we call it failed success. It's success, but ultimately it was a failure, because it didn't actually achieve what we wanted it to achieve. Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so let's go on to the next question. I'm going to actually ask somebody to ask a question who sent me one in.
Can I just say, Raj, just before you go on to the next question, because we do have a couple of spin-offs from this, and I think it's really good. And let me throw it out to you, and let me see, because, it'd be good to get your perspective on this. Daphne, I really appreciate it, because our tagline is wisdom that breathes. So she's throwing it back in our court, and Daphne is saying, how can we train people to not have this desire to compete? How can we actually, can we teach this in school? How do we get that message out to people that you don't need to compete, that just try your best? Because you can say this we can say it here on a call, like, try your best. That's the main thing. Is there anything else you would do to teach that?
Yeah, the thing that comes to mind is a quote from Albert Einstein. And he explains that if you judge a fish by how much it can climb a tree, then the fish will always end up feeling stupid. And one thing in our education system, we don't really instill, and I think maybe we're seeing a little bit of it now, but actually the idea of having an individual purpose or an individual dharma or an individual skill set. And what's really, you know, crucial for teaching, you know, the idea of it's not a competition, but it's your own growth, is actually people developing their own skills, their own nature, and growing within that nature. So what I read is, you know, in the ancient times, in the Vedic times, when kids were young, they would go to school. And at the age of five, they would have a teacher. And the teacher would get to know them, understand their nature, understand their skill set. And eventually they would kind of judge, and between them, they'll judge like, okay, this is your occupation, this is what you're really good at, and then harness and improve that skill. So actually everybody has a unique skill, a unique ability. You know, you can see it from a young age. Some people are really good at piano. Some people are good at tennis. Some people are great scientists. And when you can start align with your purpose and your dharma, and the Bhagavad Gita talks a lot about the dharma, because in chapter two, we kind of understand that you have two dharmas. One is your Sanatana dharma and one is your Swadharma. And so that essentially means one's your spiritual dharma, your eternal dharma, which means, you know, your natural connection with God, and everybody has that same spiritual dharma. But you have your own personal dharma, which means, you know, how do you contribute to this world? What makes you tick? What makes you grow? And ultimately, if you're not situated in the right dharma, you're not going to excel. You're not going to grow. You're always going to feel this lack, because A, you're competing with something. It's not naturally you. So there's always going to be a natural lack. So I think we kind of have to realize, and I guess some people realize this pretty late, but we're seeing big thing on purpose and et cetera. But we're kind of seeing now there's a modern awakening of, you know, how do I harness my own purpose? How do I harness who I really am? And I think that is the way to kind of, one aspect I would say is to teach the younger generation on feeling fulfilled. What would be your
take? I think it's a great point. And I think Sujata said really nicely that our modern educational system is like a cookie cutter scenario. I like that one. That's a good one. Yeah, it's like a conveyor belt, and it doesn't see that everyone's on a unique journey. Everyone needs to develop and pursue unique things. And Karishma says, yeah, know that you're on your own unique journey, and align with your values. Excellent. You're where you need to be. And Kunal is asking, what's the responsibility of parents towards their children? And that is kind of just to tie in with what you said, that many of you on the call are parents. And it's so important that we don't project our desires, we don't project our visions, we don't project ourselves on our children, but you encourage them, you empower them, and then you allow them to awaken the journey that they're meant to go on, and fully support them in that. And that's really an important aspect. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's so true. Like, I think parents are now, I think we're seeing more and more parents kind of understanding this, because, you know, there is a, I guess, especially if you come from an Asian background as well, there's always like a natural, you have to be a doctor, lawyer, dentist. Once I told my sister, you know, like, we're talking about my niece's future, and I was like, you can, you know, like, she can be whatever she wants, you know, like, I think she should follow her passion. And my sister just gave me the biggest evils possible. She's like, no, she needs to be a doctor or a lawyer. She needs to get a good job. So Yeah.
Just on that, Sunil's asking a good question. She's saying that if there wasn't competition in the world, wouldn't we be lower achievers? Isn't there a sense in which competition is good? It's healthy, is kind of a push to us to grow, to develop.
Are you asking me?
Yeah, I'm asking you. Or anyone else on the call, if you want to answer that, if anyone's got a thought on that, then just put your hand up. But yeah, do you have any thoughts on that? Like, what is, can competition be healthy as well?
Yeah, of course it can. There was, you know, if I think of an example, when Srila Prabhupada, who is the founder of or the author of this book we're reading, is Bhagavad Gita as it is. And when there was a whole movement, and he came and he had a lot of disciples, and what would happen is, like, all of the disciples would try and please him, or they would try and work really hard to try and show him, oh, you know, I've done something really great, etc. And what ended up happening is it ended up becoming kind of like a healthy competition, you know, like, ultimately they had the same purpose, they had the same goal, right? But they were like sort of competing with each other, but in a sort of a loving kind of way. So in one sense, yes, you can have that, you know, like, if you've got the same goal. And I think one thing I kind of always meditate, if I ever feel that thought coming through, is especially say if you're working on a project, or if you're looking to do something and you feel like, oh, the sense of competition, because it naturally does come, I always take a step back and think, this person is dedicating their time, their life, or their mission to the same thing I'm doing, or to the same thing I want to do, or they're doing something really great. And I, when I take a step back, I think there's 8 billion people out there in this world. And out of the 8 billion people, this person is doing something great and is trying their best. And that's fantastic, you know? So I kind of have to look at it in that way. So yes, it's hard, but
appreciate that they're on that journey and their effort, and use their good example of their effort to inspire your own effort and endeavor. Nice. Karina, do you want to say something about competition? You can unmute yourself. Can you? Yeah, you can.
I just wanted to say that competition is healthy. You compete with yourself, be the best version of yourself.
Yeah. So you're saying compete with yourself rather than compete with others. Yeah. It's interesting. I guess all of us are different as well. Some people really respond to competition and can deal with it without it having to degrade their mentality. Whereas others, like I, like, hate competition. Like, as soon as you say the word competition, I just get like very insecure. So I just shy away from it. So I think we're also different, and some people respond to it without degrading themselves. Whereas for others, like Meenakshi said, like, for some people, they're so passionate about what they're doing, they don't really care what anyone else out there is doing. Whereas someone might see someone else out there doing something and just that sense of, yeah, that may inspire them to grow. So yeah. Yeah. And Ava says, if their motives are selfless and their attitudes are respectful, people can have goals and want to achieve them without excellence, putting others down. Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah. When competition is about pulling other people down, then it becomes, you know, but when it's like, okay, let's compete and let's all inspire everyone to go higher, then it's kind of spiritual, yeah. It's amazing how we can take a topic and there's so many layers to it. And that's why it's great to have a bit of a conversation here so we can really frame it.
I was just going to say, I think what she just said, Eva, it comes back to the point you made at the beginning about the spiritual vacuum. You know, if you've got that, you know, spiritual connection and not a vacuum, then, you know, naturally you feel like, yeah, I'm already internally fulfilled, but this competition or whatever it is, it kind of naturally, you know, aligns you or either motivates you, or like I said, it doesn't motivate you. But, you know, if you've got that inner fulfillment, then
Yeah, definitely. Thanks everyone for your comments. Please keep them coming in. Should we move on to something else, Raj?
Yeah, we can do. Okay, I'm going to ask Venugita. She sent me three questions. Maybe I'll let you choose. You can pick one of your questions. Three of them were nice.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry I sent three. I just got really excited.
No, that's really good. We like questions, like, you know, so keep sending them in.
Okay, beautiful.
They were great.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate you calling on me so I can get the opportunity to ask at least one of them. So my first one was, how can topics such as self-care and self-love be approached through the lens of the Gita? And would you personally consider them concepts of importance to one's spiritual growth and advancement?
Wow, amazing. Thank you so much. That's a great question. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to pull up a verse from the Gita just on this. Can you just give me sharing rights, Raj Mukun? In the future, on the call to everyone, I want to share with you this program called VedaBase, which is like, this is VedaBase for some of you who may or may not know. And if you see here on the left of the screen, this is basically all the different books that Srila Prabhupada wrote. So here you have like Bhagavad Gita, which is what we're studying now. And what you can do here on the top is you can actually search things. So it's like a really like cool tool to like search up any kind of thing. But on your question, Venugita, about self-care. So this is what Krishna says about self-care in the Bhagavad Gita. So this is chapter 6. This is verse number 17. So Krishna says, one who is temperate or balanced in their habits of eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all material pains by practicing the yoga system. And then later on, Krishna says, just before that, Krishna says, there is no possibility of one becoming a yogi, O Arjuna, if they eat too much or eat too little, sleep too much or do not sleep enough. So that's really, really interesting, because what Krishna is saying is that although we're a soul, we have a body and a mind, and we have to be really balanced in the way we deal with our body and mind. And therefore, you know, for we have to take care of our body. We have to exercise. We have to give it enough rest. We have to eat well. We have to take care of our mind. Krishna says you have to give yourself recreation time. You have to give yourself time when you go away from the chaos of the world and you disconnect. And so much of the Bhagavad Gita, although it's about awakening our spiritual identity, it also talks about self-care in terms of taking care of your body, taking care of your mind, and also taking care of your spiritual well-being. And so definitely self-care is a big part of spiritual life, because the more you're healthy and balanced in your body, mind, and spiritual self, then you can actually serve, give, and love more to others. We can't give what we don't have. And therefore, sometimes we feel a little guilty in the world about taking time for ourselves. But it's important to take care of yourself, because then you can contribute more to others around you. Does that kind of help? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. And it makes complete sense that, yeah, our real identity is the soul as a living entity, but we are still in this human condition. So that also requires some level of care.
Yeah, it's like if you drive a car, like you also got to check the oil now and again, you got to check the water, you got to take it for an MOT, and you got to, you know, because it's your vehicle. So one of the kind of misunderstandings people have is they're kind of like, well, I'm not this body, I'm not the mind, I'm the soul. And that means that if I do spiritual things, then I don't need to worry about, no, but we're living within a body and mind. So we've got to take care and honor it. The body is a temple, isn't it? Yeah.
Thank you so much. Am I allowed to just ask one more question? Or
sure. For a small fee, we can do anything. I'm joking. No, sure. Please okay. Tell us.
This has been on my mind a lot, and I'm not really sure how to navigate it. Like, what is the connection between the heart, the soul, and consciousness? And are the needs of the soul the same or similar to the needs of the heart? Sorry, I forgot which one. Are the needs of the soul the same as the heart?
Oh, amazing. So you're saying, what's the connection between the soul, the heart, and consciousness?
Right.
Okay, amazing. I'll say something and then I'll hand over to Raj to add in his thoughts. So each one of us has a physical heart within our body. And it's said that the soul is seated within the heart region. So the heart, if you imagine, is like the seat of the soul. Yeah. And consciousness is the symptom of the soul. So that's the connection between them. If you think of your heart, the physical heart that you have, then it's the sitting place of the soul, because the source of all energy in the body is the heart region. And that's because the soul is situated in the heart region. So the soul sits in the heart region, and the consciousness is the symptom that a soul is present. So anywhere where there's consciousness, you can understand there must be a soul. So someone may say, then what about if someone gets a heart transplant? Does that mean someone new has come into your, like, no, it just means the sitting place has changed. So the heart is the sitting place, and the soul is the symptom of consciousness, like that. And yeah. Raj, you want to add anything to that?
No, I think that's... Yeah, I think that's pretty there, pretty much. Yeah, the heart. I think you explained it perfectly. Yeah. So, Venu, Gita, does that answer your question? Is there anything?
Yeah, that absolutely answers it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great, thank you. Okay, so we've got some great questions come in as well. Just trying to pick the best. Oh, they're all really good. So let's start with. Okay, so we've had one from Eva. And
why don't we ask Eva to come on and tell us?
Yeah, let's do that.
To hear our voice.
Eva, you're back in Spain.
Eva's
now.
Like a positive, like happy soul. She's all around. She's got such a great energy. It's great having you around the manor, Eva.
Thank you so much, Samiji. Yes, I'm back to Spain. I was really so happy and so grateful for being in the retreat and being in the manor also for a few days. It was really amazing. And I have a question from my son. He is 19 and he was telling me he hasn't read the Bhagavad Gita or doesn't know much. But he was hearing an interview by Oppenheimer, the father of the atomic bomb,
yeah.
And that he was speaking about the Bhagavad Gita, and that he had an experience when he saw the how you call that, you know, the form
the
of
atom the, bomb, yeah,
yes, that let me see the real words was like, or I mean, the words was like he was death himself or something like that. So my son was quite shocked to see how a person who was supposed to be spiritual, reading Bhagavad Gita, having an interest in Sanskrit, could do such a thing, and how it can be interpreted such a holy book to do, you know, to do a harmful act. In such a way, I mean, in this magnitude too. So I don't know if you know, because he's not here with me and I didn't have really an answer for him. So I think this is great that if I can bring his question.
Yeah, it's a really amazing question. Just to bring it up. So here I am bringing up my Veda base again. So this is the verse. So Oppenheimer was said to be the father of the atomic bomb. And when the atomic bomb, when he observed it, he actually quoted this line from the Bhagavad Gita. So you see, this is from Bhagavad Gita, chapter number 11, text number 32. And it's where Krishna says, time I am, the great destroyer of the worlds. So the context of this chapter is that Krishna is displaying a universal form, and Krishna is basically explaining how everything rests within him. And ultimately, by the time factor, everything in the world is destroyed. And so when Oppenheimer observed the atom bomb, he was said to be the father of it. Then he quoted this verse. So the question is coming that if Oppenheimer knew the Bhagavad Gita, if Oppenheimer had this spiritual wisdom, then how could he craft such a thing which is so destructive? But if you remember, sometime I think in one of the sessions I was explaining that knowledge in and of itself is not enough. Remember, Krishna says you require many, many other ingredients with knowledge in order for that knowledge to actually lead to a spiritual and compassionate and kind, devoted heart. For example, Krishna says knowledge must be accompanied by humility. Otherwise, that knowledge doesn't come to life. Later on, Krishna says that knowledge has to be accompanied by service, service to God, service to others. Otherwise, that knowledge doesn't come alive. Later on, Krishna says knowledge has to be accompanied by faith and faithful spiritual practice. Otherwise, that knowledge doesn't come to life. So what we find in the world today is that many people have knowledge, but only when you have knowledge and character does that knowledge actually really arise in its highest manifestation to create a change in the way we deal with the world. And so you often find that some of the most destructive people in the world were also people who had spiritual knowledge, but unfortunately they didn't have character. In the world today, everything is about competence, but they don't put much emphasis on character. But in spiritual circles, we realize that one may be competent in the head, but if they don't have character, then it doesn't mean it will really create a beautiful personality. So yeah, it's an important point, and so yeah, just having the knowledge is not enough. Yeah.
Thank you, Swamiji. I wanted to also to mention something that I didn't have the opportunity in the retreat, or I didn't raise my hand when you were asking about how do we know without having blind faith or something. I don't know how you yeah. said that the knowledge you are teaching or
is true. Yeah.
Is true. And I wanted to say something. I come from a different spiritual path, but I have had a really wonderful relationship during years with the community of lovers of Krishna. And to me, is the actions and that character of the devotees that really talk to me about the truth,
the proof.
Yeah. Is the service you do to the world, the joy, the peace, the generosity, is it's really, to me, it really opens my heart and makes me really have an enormous respect for the devotees and for that true truth, and that I can see in your actions that this is true. It's a truthful path, and I don't have any doubts.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. It's such a great point that, you know, and it's connected to what we've just talked about, that when you see someone has knowledge, but it actually reflects in this kind of shining character, this saintly character, divine qualities, then you think, yeah, that's the proof that they're spiritually connecting, because it's not just about what they believe, but it's about who they are as people. And we once had a very, very saintly devotee. His name was Jayananda. He was in the 60s and 70s. And he was known just for his saintliness. He was so kind. He was so gentle, so compassionate. And he would go out and meet all kinds of people, often people who were inimical, atheistic, unkind of responsive to spirituality. But he would charm them. He would connect with them. And at one point he passed away. And another devotee went to a place, and this lady had met him, and she was really like inimical, like against religion. And then she said, "Oh, where's Jayananda?" And this devotee, he said, "Oh, Jayananda, he passed away." And this lady, she just like broke down crying. She said, like, he touched my heart. You know, I've never met anyone like him. And then she looked at the devotee and she said, "I don't know who you guys are. I don't know what you guys believe in. I don't know what you guys do all day. But if Jayananda is with you, you must be good people."
Yeah.
And so that was like very nice, that just by the character of someone, you kind of think there must be something in this. Otherwise, how do you become like this? You know? Yeah, such a great point. Thank you, Eva.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Eva. And nice to see you. And hope you made it back to Spain okay. It was great to see you on the retreat. And thank you. Okay, so lots more nice comments coming in and questions. Poonam says, like, in the Mahabharata, he used to say, like, we should, it says that they should parents should focus on creating character rather than worldly comforts. So when we teach our children, we should try and focus on them. You know, not just giving them everything possible, but actually how can we develop their character? So yeah, that was really nice, Poonam. Thank you for sharing. Should we take another question?
Does anyone want to go live? You may have put something on the chat, but if you put your hand up, then you get the first go, because we want to hear people live.
Yeah, okay. So we've got
Ramya's right in.
Yeah, let's go for it. Ramya, over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Maharaj. Hare Krishna. So two questions, Maharaj. One on the leadership qualities in specific, right? What does Gita say about leadership? Are there any specific verses that we can refer to? And your takeaway is just one or two. So that's one. And second is...
Let's go with one, and then we'll go with the second. Yeah, leadership is super important. Here, it's the day of Veda base, so let's bring up a very, very famous verse from the Bhagavad Gita. Sorry, give me a second. Just give me one second. Yeah, this is Bhagavad Gita, chapter number 3, text number 21. And Krishna says, "Whatever action is performed by a great man, common men follow in his footsteps. And whatever standards he sets by his exemplary acts, all the world pursues." Just a side note here, sometimes when you read the Bhagavad Gita, sometimes you can feel like this is really patriarchal. It's always like, it's always he, it's always him, it's always men. But we just have to understand, when we're talking about men, we just think of it as humans. You know, it's just men, women, everyone. So it's not gender kind of biased. It's including everyone. So whatever great action is performed by a great person, common people follow in the footsteps. So Krishna definitely is making this point that leadership and setting a great example is really, really important. Before I answer your question, one thing I want to share with everyone is that everyone's a leader. If you're a parent, you're a leader. If you're at work and there are people who are under you, you're a leader. Even if there's one person in this world or a few people who you have influence over, you're a leader. So we shouldn't think the leaders are like, you know, Rishi Sunak or, you know, all of these. They're definitely leaders, but all of us are leaders. And what are the qualities of a good leader? There are different ways in which the qualities of good leadership are described in many, many different places. But just with regards to the Bhagavad Gita, let me think how to answer this. Okay, let me share it with you in this way. Arjuna, who's the listener of the Bhagavad Gita, his mother was Kunti. And in the famous tale of the Mahabharata, Kunti, she wanted to have children who would become the future heirs to the throne. In other words, the future rulers, the future leaders. So it said she had a boon to summon the celestial gods and then produce children by them. So the first god that she summoned was the god of justice, known as Yamaraj. And from the god of justice, Yudhisthira was born. He was, as we know, the eldest of the Pandavas. And Yudhisthira, because he was born from the god of justice, he was known for being sensitive to how to balance different situations, sensitive to understand the ramifications of any given decision. The next god to be summoned was the god of wind. And the god of wind, or Vayu, when he came down, his child was Bhima. And we know Bhima was a great fighter, very, very strong. So Bhima was known for his strength. And the third personality who was summoned, the third celestial god, was Indra, the god of heavens. And from Indra, Arjuna was born. And Arjuna was known to be the emblem of spirituality. And so some of the commentators, they say that it's not by chance that these three gods were summoned. It's not by chance that these three individuals were born. And it's not by chance that these three qualities were prominent, because these three qualities are the qualities, the cardinal qualities of good leadership. The basic three qualities of a good leader is that, number one, they're sensitive. They know how to deal with people. They're able to navigate relationships. They're sensitive to how people are feeling. They're sensitive to how a decision will play out and what ramifications it will have. In other words, they are able to understand causality very, very well. The second quality of a good leader is you have to be strong. You have to have strength of mind. You have to have resilience. You have to be able to face challenge. You have to believe in yourself and be able to walk through chaos, because every leader will be confronted with challenging situations. And underpinning all of it, every leader has to embody spirituality and selflessness. Nowadays in the corporate world, they're talking more and more about servant leadership. That every leader should see that they're actually just a servant. They're not a leader to fulfill their own agenda. They're a leader to empower, encourage, and elevate those people that are under them. And so we could say these are the three basic qualities of leadership that we learn from the Pandava brothers, that leadership means sensitivity, strength, and spirituality. That's one way to look at it. And then obviously we can unpack it more and more, and there are other things we could add to it, but just to give you a flavor.
Thank you, Maharaj. That helps. Just a follow-up question that I had on that is, when you talk about leadership or in general, the professional life, Gita also tells there should be a discipline of equanimity, right? Looking good and bad equally. But I think mind plays a crucial role when you have to think through. And sometimes when you make these decisions, not all go through your favor. So you will have both good and bad happening. So how do we, handle such a mind, right? Because mind being relentless in its own way, it keeps pushing you back. So how does Gita help calm our mind in such difficult situations and make you think good and bad are the same, right? So that's...
Okay, yeah, that's a great point. The first thing is we have to understand what are the components by which things happen in this world. Like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that the self-realized soul... Yeah, okay, let me bring up another verse. So here in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, oh, sorry, let me just move this. Okay, sorry, give me a second, everyone. Don't send that. Oh, Zoom went. Can you still hear me? Oh, you can still hear me. Okay. Okay, so here Krishna says in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, one who is not disturbed in mind, even amidst the threefold miseries, or related when there is happiness, who is free from attachment, fear, and anger, is called a sage of the steady mind. So what Krishna is basically saying is that misery and happiness are just part of life. Life is full of duality. There will be times of success. There will be times of failure. There will be times when things go according to your plan, and there will be times when things don't go according to your plan. And that's okay. But the key thing Krishna is saying here is that for the spirit soul, because they have no attachment, therefore they don't have any fear. And because they don't have any fear, therefore, they don't have any anger. Yeah, you can kind of see that these go in a line. And so the basic point is that we're living in this world. Sorry, it keeps saying my Zoom is going to crash, but it's not crashing, is it? I'm still here. Okay. Keep saying my Zoom is crashing. I don't know why. So the idea is when we become free from attachment, fear, and anger, then what happens is in the duality of this world, we don't become displaced in mind. So the problem in this world is not that there's duality, because duality you can't escape. That's just a factor of existence. But the problem comes is if we have a consciousness in which there is attachment and therefore fear and therefore anger and frustration, then when we face the duality of this world, then our mind will be displaced. And so the whole idea of spiritual practice is to free you from that attachment, which then frees you from that fear, which then also frees you from that anger. And so it's not a mental trick by which we can create a steady mind. It's basically a purified consciousness, which then controls the mind, and therefore we don't experience that kind of wavering of consciousness. Does that kind of make sense? Or do you want to follow up on that?
No, Maharaj, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, thanks.
So we can't basically steady the mind through some kind of mental adjustment. The way to steady the mind is to create a change of deeper consciousness in which we remove attachment. Because we're attached to achieving something, to having the world work out in a certain way, to enjoying something, because we have these attachments, when the duality of this world foils those plans, then naturally we become displaced. But when you take the attachment away, then you're able to more clearly see that whatever happens, there's a way forward and there's a reason why this is happening.
Yeah, that helps. Thanks a lot. Hare Krishna.
Raj, I don't know if you want to add anything to that.
Yeah, I think it's an important thing that we need to kind of, especially in the day-to-day life, because it's so natural to have attachment. And your mind, you almost end up, I think the more you kind of read the Bhagavad Gita and become more spiritual, you end up seeing that attachment from time to time come back. And it's so important to like detach. And one phrase I kind of heard very recently, and I kind of mentioned it on the retreat, is it's important that we disconnect to connect. So we disconnect from our attachments. We disconnect from, you know, our the things that are keeping us attached, and we end up, and we have to try and connect with the things that sort of keep us detached, keep us spiritually alive, you know? So yeah, I think practically when we look at it in that sense, we have to kind of realize that a lot of things are going to keep us attached. And if we can kind of, because, you know, there's two ways, like one is spiritual attachments and one is like material attachments, and spiritual attachment can always lead to positive things. You're okay, I'm attached to, like, you know, serving, I'm attached to connect, I'm attached to my practice, I'm attached to the kind of, if you have spiritual attachments, it leads to positive things. But when you have a material attachment, it kind of leads you to frustration, because look, if you're spiritually attached, you're going to really want and hanker for something. If you're hankering for that thing, what will happen is you get either frustrated because you don't get it, or you get it, and once you get it, you realize it doesn't really fulfill you, or it's not enough. And when you realize it's not enough, you kind of have that desire and greed to want it more. And when you don't get it more, well, it just leads to frustration. Frustration leads to anger. Anger leads to delusion, and the Gita describes that delusion leads to lack of intelligence. So when we lose that intelligence, we lose the ability to make the right decisions. And then you end up on a spiral of making decisions based on attachment rather than making decisions on being free from attachment. Like, so either you're moving this way because you're basing your decisions based on attachment to material things, or you want to try, or if you're like being conscious, you're making your decisions of what is elevating me, or what is moving me more to a spiritual goal or a spiritual attachment. And then naturally your decisions and your life is moving in the upward spiral, which leads you to a more solid connection and becoming more free from, you know, that attachment that you're kind of, you know, holding on to, you know. So yeah, I guess that's my like little practical take on it. I hope that helps. I don't know where Keshe Maharaj is gone.
Yeah, I'm back now. Sorry. Oh,
great.
I don't know. I was freezing, so yeah, I just logged off. There are some hands. Shall we take these final few questions? It's 9 o'clock, and then we'll try and wrap up in 10 minutes, maybe. Yeah. Palika Devi Dasi.
Hare Krishna, thank you so much for such an enlivening answer and question and answer. I was really inspired. I didn't have much question in my mind, but I just want to know whether we can hear the recording of the, you know, the whole thing. It's yeah. So many questions and answer. It was just absolutely, for me, it's really so much positive, because, you know, when you're running a Sangha, you're a mentor, and, you know, you need so many more things for you to be completely spiritual, to lead the other people. And so I got a lot of positive, you know, conversation here, which can help me to lead. So that's why I just hear, if it is possible, please. Thank you so much. Yeah,
great to have you on the call. We'll have this available on the YouTube, and you're on the network and you're on the WhatsApp. So we'll send the link out for sure.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much. And Maria, over to you.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, thank you so much for the wisdom and for all the great questions that you've answered. There's a lot to learn in your every session. I guess my question is more like a practical question, also a bit of a reflection on my personal situation, where I'm trying to balance and to walk a balanced line between having a career and also deepening my relationship with Krishna every day, and my spirituality, and just developing that sincere relationship, and that comes from a pure heart, and like keeping myself also in that pure state whilst being in a corporate world. So I guess my question is about like the practical, or like, you know, what is your view on that, and how can I continue to do that? Because my own being and the way I am, and also living in London, I have to focus on my career, because that's, you know, and also like Krishna wants us to be successful, and Krishna wants us to be prosperous. And like, you know, he gives us some, like, I don't know, he gives us a career, he gives us a job. So we also obviously have to perform in that job and do our best, and dedicate the results to Krishna. But how do I continue to deepen my relationship on an everyday basis?
Amazing. Such a good question. Yeah. Well, let me give you three layers. I think you can look at it in three stages. How to live out their function in the world, in your career, and continually spiritually develop yourself. How do you, like, they have CPD, like continuous professional development. Like, how do you do CSD, continuous spiritual development, while you're working out there in the world? So here's one thing, like, I think on the basic level, the first thing is that a lot of your spiritual development at work and utilizing the opportunities you have at work to be spiritual and connect with Krishna, a lot of it is founded upon what you do before and after work. And therefore, we really, really encourage everyone, before you go to work, before you're out there, spend some time in your sacred space. If it's half an hour, if it's an hour, where you do some reading, some meditation, some chanting, and you really set your spiritual intention for the day, then what will happen is, out there in the world, you will begin to see divinity. You will begin to see opportunities to serve. You will begin to see the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita in front of you. But when we don't start with that spiritual intention, everything in the world, our work, our colleagues, the experiences, the events, the emotions, everything feels disconnected. So your morning routine is the means of establishing that connection and spiritual vision. So that's the first layer. The second thing I want you to think about is, at your work and when you're out there in the world, there are a plethora of opportunities opening up for you to serve others, to see Krishna, to elevate your consciousness. And so I want you to think, like, when you're at work and you're interacting with all these people, how can you now form your relationships at work so that they're providing some spiritual upliftment? What can you do in those relationships? Maybe you can think about the skills that you're learning in work and how you can begin to bring some kind of spirituality and utilize those skills for spiritual purpose. When you're at work, you know, you're moving in different circles, you're gaining positions of influence, you're able to, you know, bring ideas in. How can you bring spiritual ideas in? So the second thing I want you to think about is, how can you bring more and more spiritual connection into the things you're doing, the things you're achieving, the things you're gaining from your professional life? And then the third thing, which is a more long-term thing, is how can you then eventually move into a career which is basically giving you a living, utilizing your skills, but is your spiritual contribution to the world. And over time, we have to find a career, if we can, that that fits that that description. You know, it's and it's not something that usually just comes like overnight in one go. It's something that you will have to work on, something that you will have to develop, something that you will have to craft bit by bit. But eventually, that's where we want to go. I'm just going to show you something on my screen. Yeah. Eventually, you want to try and get here. Yeah. You need to try and, we need to try and get here. Something you love doing, something you have ability for, something that's making a contribution to the world, something that you're paid for. Yeah. Something that allows you to create a living. Yeah. And something that ultimately brings spirituality and can be used in service. Yeah. And that's where we want to go. So right now we may be just doing our passion, or we may be just doing a profession, or we may just be doing a vocation. So we need to try to move towards that space where we can. One person said to me, your daydream has to become your day job. And we may say, well, that's utopian. That's just not the way life is. You have to do a job. You don't, you know, that's no, but maybe we don't. Maybe over time, if we're constantly trying and working and crafting, then we can eventually get to that space. Yeah. So some thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It's very useful. Thank you so much, Maharaj. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Okay, Shriya, I think you get the last say.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. It's so wonderful to talk to you lively. So it's like a personal question, and it's similar to what you just explained. So this has been going in my mind since years, I would say. So I'm stuck in a job right now, which is none of it what you described, you know, like I'm just doing it because I had like a educational background, and then because you know how parents just want you to be a certain in a certain profession. So that followed for years, and then so I'm stuck in a job right now, but then I don't know where to start from, you know, how to find that balance of passion and something which can be, which makes me happy as well, and something which is fulfilling, and something which is also a contribution from my part to the world, you know. So I tried Googling, and I'm just in a loop, you know. I try, and then I'm like, oh, this might take like 2 or 3 years to complete, which I don't want to sign up for. So I come back to my job, and then again the next day I'm like, oh, I cannot do this. So it's just going on forever. And then whenever I'm in a social setting, you know, with people who are more advanced in terms of material wealth or in their career or anything, it just makes me feel inferior, you know. It's like they are talking about their job and their business, and then I'm like, oh, I'm nothing, you know. So how do I get out of this? Like, how do I clear out this brain fog in my mind, which is like going on for years?
Yeah. Well, as I mentioned to Anna Maria, I think the first thing is, Shriya, like, you know, Zuckerberg, he once said, we underestimate what we can do in 10 years and we overestimate what we can do in 1 year. So often, because our mind is wanting like such instantaneous change, we set these high expectations that within 6 months, I should have transformed my life. And it's just too much for that time frame. But we underestimate what we can do over a period of time because we tend not to have a long-term vision. So what I would say, Shriya, is the first thing is have a long-term vision. Say that I'm going on this project to find my dharma, to find a profession which utilizes my skill, which I can use in service, and which I love doing. But I accept the fact it's going to take time. It's going to take 5-10 years, and I have to give myself that time. But the journey begins today, and the journey begins with small steps, you know. So you don't have to sign up to a 2.5-year course in teaching to figure out if that's your dharma, but you can begin doing some teaching or observing or doing some short courses and getting a taste of it. You can begin exploring. You can begin interfacing with different people who do different things and seeing what their life is like. Just become an explorer. Just become someone who's inquisitive, who's trying different things. And through that experimentation and that dynamic journey, things will come to you. The universe and Krishna and Providence will arrange you to come across people. Doors of opportunity will open. Things will conspire in a certain way that seems to lead you towards what you're meant to do. But you have to trust in that path and just walk that path. So I guess what I'm saying to you is, number one, just accept the fact that it's going to take time, and don't feel that if you haven't nailed it in 6 months that you're somehow failing. The second thing is just keep learning, keep trying, and just explore, be an explorer. And the third thing is that, you know, interface with different people and see what comes up. See what Providence is arranging, what opportunities are coming. And just go on that journey, you know. So Rome wasn't built in a day, you know. So you have to give yourself time and let that story unfold. Yeah. Raj, you want to say anything on that?
Yeah. It's interesting because if I look at my personal life, I made like a 5-year plan, you know, like this. I made a list of where I want to be in the next 5 years. And the interesting thing is that when I look back at that list, I feel like I've accomplished a lot of the things that I actually had put on that list. But what it was is, I don't always constantly check, you know, what's my, am I my 5-year plan? Am I in front? It is something I did before, but then once I look back on it 5 years from now, and then I broke it down, actually, it just helped me set like, okay, like every step of decision I'm taking eventually will move towards like whatever goal I've set or wherever I want to be. So yeah, like what Maharaj is saying is, on one hand, you have to look at the bigger picture. You know, it's like, you know, you have to have the end in mind. You know, there's a book called 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. And one of the things he said, you know, have the end goal in mind. So in that sense, that's true, because that helps you, you know, maybe reach wherever you want to go. But in the same context, you know, you should be looking back at your past 1 year or past, you know, like past week, etc., and looking at, okay, what are the small steps am I going to take? You know, it's like one of the things they say, you know, when you're walking a tightrope, if you're walking a tightrope and the moment you look ahead, you're going to fall down. Like if you just keep looking ahead, you're going to fall down. You have to look at the next step. You have to look at the small steps that you're taking. But ultimately, you know where you're going. You know the destination. But on a day-to-day basis, you're looking at, okay, what are the small steps I'm going to take? And are these steps going to be eventually where I want to reach? It's very magical, actually. And actually, you know, something amazing happens because the, you know, Krishna or God will eventually move things in your favor if you have that right endeavor to, you know, be in situated in the right person, right place, where you can serve, where you can give, where you can make a right intention. So if you've got that final goal as the right goal, then things will move into place where that will help support you and get you to where you need to be. You mentioned that you were meeting people socially and they were like, you know, talking about the material things, etc. But ultimately, that might probably not give them the satisfaction from within. Your mission or your goal is maybe more spiritual, and you want to connect with that, you know. So I think that if you have that in mind always, then you'll always naturally be situated in the right direction. So yeah,
I think in the next coming months, we should just do like a couple of sessions on the Gita and Dharma and finding purpose, because we tend to give quite general answers here, which probably do help in some way. But I think we do, because it's coming up again and again, it seems as though for all of us, that's a big topic. So we'll just watch out for that. In the next couple of months, we'll do something and we'll really try and break it down. And maybe we'll try and bring in some live case studies of how people out there have found their Dharma and hear a little bit from them. So yeah, thank you for raising this, because it helps us to know what's on everyone's mind, so we can do that.
That would be great.
Yeah.
That would be great, yeah. Thank you so much.
Raj, I'm just seeing hands from CJ, Ashwin and Hino, and I think we should hear them all out before we close up today, although it's 9:20. So we'll give them all a few minutes to share with us the final gems of wisdom. CJ, over to you. You're on mute, CJ.
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you very much. I'm really enjoying the Q&A and the wisdom. I got to looking at the Gita here, chapter 18:47. And if you don't mind me to read it, or you're going to share the screen there with that.
Yeah, I'll share it, but you can read it also.
You know, it's better to engage in one's own occupation, even though one may perform it imperfectly, than to accept another's occupation and perform it perfectly. And what I understand by that is trying to switch between varnas is quite tricky. When you're in the outside world, operating at the level that you have to, there is always some contamination. And it's not always understood how to accommodate that contamination, as if we've got to be holier than thou in a particular occupation. So here it says here, Prabhupada says in the purport a little further down, in the business field, also sometimes a merchant has to tell so many lies to make a profit. If he does not do so, there can be no profit. So sometimes a merchant says, oh, my dear customer, for you I'm making no profit. But one should know that without profit, the merchant cannot exist. So I think there's a little bit further down there that even the brahmana gets contaminated because he has to perform sacrifice on animals. So it's often, I think we're kind of sent up in this understanding of Dharma and purity to being more than what we possibly can be in a particular occupation. And you said it needed to deserve more time, but it can throw us off when we're in the everyday world, and it's just the energy and the nature of that. And even in the Brahminical world, when we're really in it, like you said, that a leader has to face so many challenges, it's accommodating that and realizing what is real here. Because otherwise, we're all sitting on a cloud after these classes. And it's a lot more intense and sometimes ugly in the name of pursuing a purity and trying to remain pure. I don't want to say any more, because I think you can add so much.
I think you raise a really good point, and we do need to factor that into the discussion, that there's the ideal and then there's the achievable, and we have to be realistic and realize that finding your Dharma and being in your Dharma is important, but there is also a higher thing that we're aiming for and not to lose sight of that higher thing in the pursuit for perfecting your dharma and trying to live perfectly here. So, yeah, I appreciate. Yeah,
it might sound like not like I might have sounded like not a question, but in fact, I was just deliberating on it a little, but then hoped I could turn it into a question to say, Maharaj, what do you do in that situation? You know, what you know, because yeah. That's really it, really. So maybe I wish I could have been able to turn it into a question, but it just came up like that.
No, and I think these comments, we will take them, and we definitely want to do a session on Dharma or a couple of sessions, and we'll kind of unfold it more there. But thank you, CJ. Really appreciate your inputs. Great. We'll just take the final two comments. Ashwin, I don't know, there's three of you in the room, and I'm guessing not all of you are Ashwin. So please unmute yourself. Be great to hear from you.
I think that's Valentina, is it?
Oh, that's Valentina. Yeah, of course, right. You need to unmute yourself. Can you do it? Okay. While you guys figure that out, shall we take Hinal?
Yeah.
Hare Krishna, Prabhuji. Dandavat Pranam. My question is not anything in particular with Gita, but it's something to do with this book on self-realization, where Srila Prabhupada said that, you know, we should speak truth, even though it's unpalatable. And I've never seen anyone being so directive, and being directive means, you know, he has achieved so much of, he has achieved the most, in terms of, you know, the followers and, you know, keeping people, you know, aware of what he actually thinks. Whereas in, you know, in a real world, we've been given so many lectures on how to give feedback and, you know, how to be palatable and not to say things which can upset people. So I don't know, you know, where we should strike balance as, you know, in one sense, we say that, you know, we should take things from spiritual world and apply at work. And when we actually try to be, you know, more directive in terms of, you know, what is right and what is wrong, and not try to keep people in the dark, it can easily upset them, and, you know, it can be seen as being less sensitive.
Yeah, great. Very good question, Hinal. I'll just make a quick answer to it, and it deserves a longer answer, but I'm just going to show you a very quick verse from the Bhagavad Gita. So this is 17:15. And this is what Krishna says about speech. Speech should be consist of words that are truthful, pleasing, beneficial, and not agitating to others, and also in regularly reciting Vedic literature. So generally, what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita is that speech should be truthful, it should be pleasing, and it should be beneficial. So we don't go around trying to speak words which are unpalatable. Generally, we try to speak words which are always pleasing, beneficial. But what Srila Prabhupada is making the point is that sometimes, in order to reveal higher truths, and out of compassion, and in order to truly help someone, sometimes you may have to say an unpalatable truth for a higher purpose. And in that situation, it is actually a demonstration of one's kindness. A parent sometimes has to tell off their children. That's unpalatable, but it's for a higher good. And sometimes someone has to speak out against an injustice and use strong words, but that's for a higher purpose. And so if there's a higher purpose involved, then we may have to speak an unpalatable truth. But generally, Krishna says, Satyam, speak words which are truthful. Priyam, speak words which are pleasing. Hitam, speak words which are beneficial. And in occasions where you may have to say something unpalatable, ensure that your motivation is right and that you're actually doing it because it's necessary and there's no other way. Then such unpalatable truths are also considered a demonstration of one's saintliness and kindness and compassion. I hope that helps.
Thank you, Prabhuji. That's a brilliant, brilliant answer. Thank you.
Okay, are we going back to Ashwin and Valentina, or?
I don't know.
Paul.
Okay, yes, you're on.
It's three of us. It's Trimurti today.
Yeah. Amazing.
Just a quick maybe greetings to everyone. I sent a questions, but maybe we can have in the smaller circle. So this is like Krishna making me having a good network here. And also I'm facing a quite difficult situation back in Italy because of my mom health. She's being diagnosed with cancer. And the moment I start Think Gita, this life quake was starting. And now it came to a point of me asking myself a lot of questions. But at the same time, I don't know whether it's Krishna, Bhagavan, or whatever. I'm still very confused with all of this. But even the care, my mom now, she has a helper. And she told me in the kitchen, you know, the caregiver, she was like, I was kind of complaining because I don't fit in the Catholic upbringing that I had. I'm the only one who do yoga and do Indian dance. And I was like, what can I do? We don't choose our parents. And the caregiver was like, we do choose our parents. And I was like, oh, do you believe in all this karma and reincarnation? And she was like, yes. And I was like, okay. And she was like, tomorrow I'm going to Villa Vrindavana. So I don't know, it was all kind of serendipity. And even being here with these devotees, it's all like this. But my question mainly was, I feel guilty for being here outside of my country, pursuing maybe something that can be egoistic, which is my spiritual path and my, I don't know, artistic dream. And having a mother who is now suffering over there. I have put a long question, so maybe I can reach out in private because it's a bit, you know, long and sensitive. But again, it's two dharmas, like the dharmas of that I feel is good for me and the family one. Because as, you know, it's an in, family is important in my culture and also for the Hindu Sanatan Dharma, whatever. So, but I don't fit in my family reality. So why do I feel guilty? That mainly was the question. Thank you.
Wow, amazing. Yeah, such a good point. Well, basically, yeah. Valentina, you're going through exactly what Arjun was going through, because Arjun was like, I have a duty to my family. I have a duty as a warrior. I have a duty as a husband. And I also have a duty as a spiritual being. And Krishna, it seems like all of these duties are clashing. And how do I fulfill all of these duties? Because it seems as though when I pursue one of them, then it means I neglect another one of them. And so life is often like that. It's we're balancing, it's a juggling act, and we're balancing different things. At different times in our life, we need to put emphasis on different things. Sometimes we may have to step away from certain spiritual commitments because we do have a duty in the world that requires our time and energy at this point. And sometimes we have to also step away from material duties and say, I need to spend this time for spirituality, because if I don't spiritually fulfill myself, I'm not going to be able to help anyone. And so there's never a right and wrong answer. It's just we have to consciously, constantly question our motivations and try to ask ourselves, like, am I doing this sincerely? Am I doing it for a greater good? Like, where is this going to go in the future? So I don't think I could give an answer to your situation. And of course, we can always discuss your situation and look at it more closely. And oftentimes we can find a way in which there's a win-win situation. So we can like, you know, find a way in which all of those dharmas can be satisfied. But in some situations, it may not be possible. So we just have to adjust. You see, life is like riding a bike. You never go in a straight line. You're always adjusting. And that's how you stay in balance. So like, dharma is like that also. We have competing dharmas and we have to always put our attention in multiple places and balance everything. So I hope that gives some idea and we can talk more. But thank you. Thank you all for being present.
For the upcoming sessions.
Thank you. Raj, I'll hand over to you to close us up.